Welcome to the Restaurant Boiler Room, Season 6, Episode 2. I'm your host, Rick Ormsby, Managing Director at Unbridled Capital. Today in the Boiler Room, I'll be answering franchise-related questions about M&A market conditions, cap rates, lending markets, and factors influencing a turnaround. It'll be a good way to get some quick insights real time. The Restaurant Boiler Room is a one-stop shop for multi-million dollar merger and acquisition activity and financial complexities affecting the franchise industry. We talk money, deals, valuations, and risk delivered to the front door of franchisees, private equity firms, family offices, large investors, and franchisors on a monthly basis. Feel free to find our content at Unbridled Capital's website at www.unbridledcapital.com. Now, let's enter the boiler room. Well, hope you are doing well, and thanks for checking in. Our last episode was kind of a three-way with a couple of guys in our office, and we were talking about what we expect the State of the Union to be for 2024. And so I kind of wanted to field some questions that came in from the peanut gallery over the, you know, the last 30 days or so, you know, and so I'll kind of have six or seven questions that I'll just kind of read and then give the answers to. And I think it'll be a good place to just kind of sink your teeth for the next coming months, because things have changed a little bit in our industry. It's amazing. Like, change is always constant, right? It's one of the one constants in life is that things change. But it's just amazing after doing this for all these 20 plus years that the change since 2020 has just continued to be kind of hard to have predicted. I know you all understand that, but I wonder when the world will become a normal place again. I don't know that it ever will. But before we get going, I'll say a couple of things. One is, by the time you listen to this, we're going to be in the throes of college basketball season and the NCAA tournament. Like, what a fantastic time of year. And I don't know those of you who follow the tournament, but it's one of my favorite things. You know, I'm a Kentucky native. You know, I live in Florida, obviously, now, but the you know, I'm Kentucky through and through. And in the little old state of Kentucky that doesn't have, you know, professional sports teams, we've always gravitated towards college basketball. And so this time of year is always really fun. Down in the Pensacola area here, the Sun Belt Conference Tournament is every year. And there are 14 teams in the Sun Belt Conference. They're kind of mid-major Division I teams, not teams you might, you know, come across every, you know, every day. But like, the number one seed in this year's tournament is Appalachian State. And I think number two might be Arkansas State or Texas State, one or the other. But my son and I and some of his Bible study buddies, we sneak down to watch these games, because you can sit like four or five rows off the bench. And yet to feel the pressure and like the anxiety and how badly these athletes want to win, because the winner of the tournament gets probably the conference's only bid to the NCAA tournament. It's kind of exciting. So we got that going for us. And, you know, that'll be a fun part of the spring if you enjoy that. I wanted to give a shout out to our team primarily. We just, you know, every year the Franchise Times organization comes out with a Deal Maker of the Year awards. We're a five-time prior winner. If memory serves me right, we've won all five of those prior awards in the last 3 years, which is really awesome, right? 1 year, 2023, we won three different awards. And they give out like somewhere around 10 awards, right? And only a couple of them are ones where, you know, franchisee M&A firms could actually win or play a portion of a win in. So, you know, so it's like, it's even more exacerbated. Like, if we won five of these things and now a sixth this year over the last 3 or 4 years, there's probably only like 15 to 20 chances to win six awards, right? So I'm blessed and honored to tell you that we just won our sixth Dealmaker Award, which, I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but we must be winning darn near half of the awards that they're giving out, which is a real testament to the team we have. And I just brag on them for a minute. You know, we've got a small but just really smart, dedicated group of guys and girls who work for us. And Unbridled Capital is just really healthy, and I'm just real honored for that. Our team has really just been stable and strong, and really thankful for that. This year's award, we won not for any particular deal we closed. This award was actually a little bit better, I think, which is we have closed over the time frame they were studying, which is more than a year, a little less than a year and a half. Unbridled Capital closed 17 transactions, which incorporates a little bit of 2022 and then basically the whole year of 2023, which, I mean, that 17 transactions is well below our average during that time frame. But given the market conditions over the last year and a half or so, which as you've, if you've been listening, you know kind of that things have changed a little bit. And we'll talk more about that today. Like, you know, I would say that our industry is probably down at least 50% right now, you know, in terms of acquisition activity. Not only that, but, you know, the value of the acquisition activity changes when, you know, when the prices might be down a little bit for one reason or the other. So to be recognized for the amount of deals we are doing is really a testament, I guess, to the market share that we have in our industry. And I'm, you know, really super honored and thankful for that. And to throw another basketball kind of thing at you, I was thinking about it, 6-time Dealmaker Award champion. So I was thinking, like, okay, who won 6 championships in the sports arena? I'm going to pause for a second. Well, yeah, Michael Jordan, right? So I was like, what a neat little parallel. I'm going to put out like a little, maybe a little ad in their paper that talks about, we got 6 championships, just like the Bulls, 91, 92, 93, 96, 97, 98. Maybe that sounds a little cocky or something. It's not meant to be. It's just kind of fun. But 6 awards, it's an honor. Okay, a couple of the questions that we're going to answer today, I'll read them off and then I'll just kind of go through them one by one. So one of them coming in is, what's the current state of affairs in our industry, if different than what we talked about, you know, on our podcast, or pardon me, on our webinar in this podcast in January? Because as I'm speaking to you now, we're, you know, 45 to 60 days past that period. And so a lot of what we talked about in January is what we expect to happen. And then, of course, it unfolds and you adjust and you're never sure what's going to happen. So that's one question. Which brands are active, you know, or you're seeing franchisees selling in this market? I'll touch on that a little bit too. How's the lending market and how's it versus what you expect? You know, I'll take temperature on that and give you some thoughts. What's needed for a turnaround in our industry? Okay. You know, I'll try to answer that one as well. Lots of positive press on new concepts, coffee particularly, but also chicken, et cetera. What do you think, Rick? Okay. I can answer that. And then I'll end with this one, which is, how are the cap rates doing right now? I hope that we will have kind of a webinar will turn into a podcast later this summer or maybe in the fall potentially, where we kind of like delve into an entire like 45 minutes or an hour talking about cap rates. Because I know a lot of you who listen, you know, have real estate holdings and probably want a general update on that anyway. So that's going to be just, I'll talk about that for 5 or 6 minutes today, but we'll do more of that later on in the year. So stay tuned. First one is, current state of affairs if different than what we said in January. You know, I think, as I'm thinking back to what we said in January for the State of the Union, I guess I would just probably tag the industry right now as maybe being slightly more negative than what I thought it was going to be in January for the year in 2024. You know, it's not that I feel like the sky is falling, but over the last 45 to 60 days, we continue to field calls from clients who have businesses that are declining, you know, and I know probably in this market, that's likely the people who will be calling, not the ones who are wanting to sell because their business is awesome and they're trying to get the highest price that they could get over the next 20 years. You know what I mean? Because that's just not the market conditioning right now. But the amount of phone calls for people who are wanting to sell healthy businesses, those calls have dropped this year so far, more so precipitously than what I thought would happen. I thought, generally speaking, that after 2022 and 2023, that we'd find 2024 kind of having a pickup of M&A activity again, right? Because the idea was, all right, in 2021, we had a bunch of activity because of great market conditions, low interest rates, and don't forget the threat of possible higher capital gains taxes, which caused a lot of sellers to get off their seat and sell. Joe Manchin of West Virginia, you know, stopped that from happening, if you'll remember the storyline there. But those are pretty powerful reasons, in addition to really high sales and really low, you know, cost of goods or food costs at that time. So 2021 pulled forward a lot of sellers, and that would necessarily mean in the wake of that, that 2022 and 2023 probably were going to be, you know, less than normal years, even in a normal economy. But what we ended up getting in 2022 and 2023 were high cost inflation. I mean, your, you know, bag of Fruity Pebbles is more expensive now than it was in 2021, right? In many cases, a lot more expensive. And the cost of labor has persisted high. So, like, in addition to the fact that we pulled forward a lot of the would-be sellers in 2021, 2022 and 2023 kind of left people on the sideline because their businesses weren't doing overly well, right? And why would you sell a business unless there was a real reason, like your board of directors is telling you to sell? That would be a reason, and you have like a fund objective where you have to sell this franchise business at year 6 plus or minus 6 months or else, right? You have to liquidate it. That would be a reason to sell regardless of the environment. Or, you had some, first generation or second generation franchisees who were just tired and psychologically tired and might say, I'm willing to just sell for a price that's 10 or 15% lower. That's okay. But over the course of a 40-year investment, it's been a great career and I'm not going to let the last, 5 or 10 or whatever percent, dictate, my timing because I'm ready to do it. Or you may have some element of distress or personal change in circumstance that causes someone to want to sell something, even when it might not be the best time. So we had those kinds of activities. And the other type of seller is, frankly, within every slightly gray market, where things aren't the best, you have like examples of brands that are doing awesome, that are kicking butt and taking market share, and where that, so they're not experiencing that kind of drift. Or you have some franchisees that are bucking the trend because they're just awesome operators and they use, difficult times to sharpen their axe and sharpen their sword and do better, right? So you have those kind of situations too, where you have some businesses that are just doing really well and bucking the trend. But generally, when you layer on those factors on top of kind of the pull forward from 2021, we knew 2022 and 2023 would be a little bit weak, right? What I thought would happen was that in 2024, we'd start seeing just the supply come back a little bit, right? It's like, gosh, there's got to be some people that after a couple years of sitting on the sideline, now they're 3 years older and they're like, it's going to be time to sell this year and I'm ready to come back to the market. So that was the first thing that I was postulating on that really so far this year has not come true. I think we have gotten a lot of inbound calls in the last 45 or 60 days, but they aren't of the variety of people who are ready to sell a healthy business and are ready to sell it and go. It's more like the calls are in many cases are still the same calls of the people that would only sell because they had to, either because of distress or a board decision or some other reason. If you're a buyer and you see a healthy business on the market right now, it likely means that they had to sell for a reason that was unrelated to the profitability of their business. And because of that, if you're doubling down in your brand or in this space and you see a good opportunity, it might be the perfect time to buy something that's healthy that comes out, right? Because for whatever reason, the person that's selling this business probably didn't time it right, but needs to sell for a reason. And if it's a good business and you still believe in the health of the brand that you're looking at, then it might absolutely be the right time because profits are likely down a little bit and the EBITDA multiple has dropped a little bit too. You might be able to pick something up for 20% less than you could have a couple of years ago. And it's the same investment, right? If you have the same perspective on the brand's future, that's a good thing. But overall, most of the phone calls we're getting are from people that have struggling businesses and they've been, hit with increased costs. But most importantly, now in 2024, we're starting to see sales drag and traffic in many brands and in many locations really drop a lot, So if you're bucking the trend, which about probably, I'm just kind of throwing it out there. If we have like, let's call it 12 or 13 clients right now, we probably have 3 or 4 of them that are bucking the trend and have great EBITDA increases every month and have strong traffic and things are looking great. But probably 2/3 of the clients, the remaining 8 or 9 or whatever that number is, are probably the ones that aren't doing well, that traffic is down pretty substantially, in many cases double digits, and sales, they're feeling like they can't take any more sales increases because the cost of their the food products in the stores are right now the cost is too high, and that's one of the reasons why traffic is dropping. I think I've said this before, if you just kind of pull into your normal fast food location in your community, I think we're all noticing that the prices of the number 5 meal, for example, are way higher than they used to be, right? And it's justified because costs have been so high, but a customer is only willing to pay that amount of money for so long. So I think that's been the negative drag a little bit on the first quarter of this year so far. I would say that I think I'll revise my prior thinking that 2024 might be the year of the turnaround and maybe high supply of good deals return to the market. I now am probably saying, without much certainty, of course, but I'm now probably saying that that's not going to happen this year at all. And we may be in the spring of 2025 before we start seeing, you know, or maybe even the summer of 2025 before we start seeing those conditions change. And we see like a return of really, of a lot of really healthy businesses to the marketplace. Keeping in mind that these businesses sell typically as a multiple of their trailing 12-month financial statement. So most healthy businesses are going to be timing things when they have a healthy 12 trailing months or 13 periods of financial information. That's going to be something to watch as we go forward. Okay, that's the answer to number one. The second is, which brands are active? Well, you know, if I look at our pipeline at the moment, I cannot really say with a whole lot of certainty that there's a pattern. We're probably involved in more Pizza Hut, KFC, and Popeyes transactions than we've been involved in the past, as a percentage of our total deal flow. Okay, we've also right now are at a lower than average amount of Taco Bell businesses that we're selling, for example. You know, so, and I think, you know, same with Burger King potentially. And, you know, Burger King's going through a turnaround. They've got some great news that they're coming out with publicly, and a lot of decent comments from the franchisees about the new management team. So I think there's good news on the horizon there. But clearly there's not as much, you know, strong deal flow out there either. So those are kind of some of the factors I guess I would note. The brands in terms of their level of activity. Otherwise, you know, some of the deals that we're taking would be just kind of one-off large first-generation franchisees in various brands who are making decisions to sell or to raise capital based on particular circumstances. So it's kind of hard to see a pattern otherwise. Whether, you know, here's something to a couple of things to think about. Number one, we have not seen an increase in calls at all, you know, from California now that the $20 minimum wage with inflation to it has been made public and is all over the news. So I think largely, you know, either we're not getting phone calls or franchisees know that their businesses are going to take a little while to adjust to those increases in wage costs before they have a business that gets stabilized and they can sell it for a price if they want to. So I'm not seeing any change of flooding of deals to the market in California or anything like that. I guess the other comment I would make is, you know, if we look at the types of sellers that we are getting the phone calls from, whether they're independent, like first generation or second generation franchisees versus sponsors or financially backed organizations, you know, I'd say that blended trend is coming in about like it has in the past. You know, we have a couple of, you know, assignments with boards of directors or with financial sponsors who are influencing a sale for particular reasons related to their return on investment or their fund life. Seems to be about normal, maybe a bit of an uptick in those kinds of phone calls versus the past. That may be highly correlated, though, with the fact that 7 or 8 years ago, for example, we didn't have as many financial buyers and operators in the system to begin with, right? So there weren't that many phone calls being made that way. But I think we still see a pretty steady diet of first and second generation franchisees, independently owned, who are the ones making these phone calls to us. Okay, that's number two. The third question is, how are the lending markets? Well, isn't it the case that these darn lenders only lend you money when you don't need it? And when you do need it, they won't lend it to you. I don't know, man. It's the way someone once told me that. It was a kind of an old farmer guy. And I was like, you know, he's probably right about that. But I'll remain with the comment that lenders see things typically 3 to 6 months in arrears. They're typically going to see their clients or a brand's performance after the quarter is completed, and then probably 2 months after the quarter is completed, because the information has to be assimilated in P&Ls and then sent to them, right, for their covenant compliance work. So for this reason, most lenders are typically, I'd say, 4 to 5 months or 6 months behind the curve of what an M&A advisor would see in terms of trends. Make sense? So we typically, oh, good old Rick and the Unbridled team and investment bankers like us probably see trends developing before they, you know, as they're happening in real time. Lenders, not so much. So the lenders are, in my opinion, quite frigid at the moment. You know, there's plenty of liquidity, which is good. you do get increasing amount of lip service from the lenders, right? You know, we're in the market of lending businesses. We're doing this, we're doing that. But then you ask, like, how many deals have you actually closed with new clients in the last 90 days? And you're going to, if you ask specific questions like that, you're going to hear pretty, you know, pretty low answers in many cases. I do think lenders I'm seeing are doubling down pretty hard on their best clients. So like anything else, if you are excellent at what you do as a franchisee and you're looking to acquire, you're going to have plenty of liquidity. There's a lot of competition at the top for the best franchisees that are underlevered and operating well. And because we don't have a lot of recapitalizations going on right now, because not a lot of M&A activities out there, and not a lot of people are trying to redo their financing at all right now, unless they have to, because the interest rates have gone up so much. I do think there's just like this massive supply-demand issue, right? There's sales reps on the lending side that are losing their jobs, you know, almost by the day. You know, every time I send an email to the lending community, it seems like there's more and more people that are not with their current employer anymore. So on the sales side, they're going to be aggressive. The problem is, in the way you got to think about it, is what is underwriting? How is underwriting thinking about these loans? And I think it's gotten kind of chilly and frigid this year, and it'll probably stay that way for some time because of the same store sales patterns and traffic patterns in our industry. So generally speaking, you know, the lenders are going to want, they've had some pretty unhealthy change in their deposits, and loan to deposit ratios have kind of worsened. You know, that's 6 to 9 months ago now, but still they're really adamant in many cases that they get the deposits on the loans that they make, which is really kind of, you know, it seems like not being able to see the forest through the trees, but that's how they continue to operate at the moment. And I think you have a really big turn away from lenders on brands that are struggling. In some cases, the question is not, can we find three or four lenders to get interested in our deal? It's more the question of, is any lender interested in this brand right now? And I think the answer in some cases is going to be no. And if along the way you have any questions or want to call me about that, you know, about your particular brand or some insights or questions, I mean, feel free anytime. Okay, so that's how are lending markets. The next one would be, what is needed for a turnaround? What is needed for a turnaround? And by a turnaround, I guess the question is, what is needed for, you know, the M&A sector, franchise M&A sector, to turn around, to go from what might be a drop in the last 3 years of 50 to 60 to 70% back to something that's maybe more healthy, predictable, and regular? You know, like I said earlier, it's like unlikely to happen in 2024. Yeah, I hope it happens in 2025. But I think there's like three or four levers that have to be explained to make this kind of, to answer this question. I mean, the first really is, and the most important is, how's the P&L look? Given that trailing 12-month or trailing 13-period financials are the way that our industry prices these deals typically, obviously with the look of historical years too, the first thing I would think about is, you're going to start seeing a healthy return of healthy sellers to the marketplace that will increase the M&A activity when you see that the businesses are showing, you know, relatively stronger trailing 12-month EBITDA and sales performance. And at the same time, you're going to see buyers return generally too when that's the case. Like, right, when the margins go from, I mean, this is just an example, it's a silly example, but say the margins go from, you know, 10% to 13% or 11% to 15%, again, you're going to see buyers re-enter the marketplace because that's a model that becomes more attractive to both, you know, kind of financial buyers and for strategic buyers too. And also when those margins jump back up to 15%, if they do, depending on the brand, or maybe it's 8% to 12% or whatever the margins are, you're going to start seeing, you're going to see more people sell because the price of their business is going to be higher, right? Just by a simple matter of taking their EBITDA and multiplying it by a multiple. So that's the first piece. We're kind of, and I kind of don't feel like right now we're there. I kind of feel like 2023 trailing 12-month financials were way better than in most cases than 2022. But for 2024, for the first quarter of the year, I would say, again, like I said earlier, two-thirds of the brands and operators out there aren't doing as well as they did in 2023 at the same time, both on a sales and maybe also on an EBITDA perspective. Some are bucking the trend and doing great, and those are the businesses that are receiving lots of interest. But lots aren't, more than half aren't, for sure. That's the first piece. We got to get the trailing 12 P&L healthy and relatively stable as well, not herky-jerky like it's been. You know, the second factor that would influence an M&A turnaround would be, you know, interest rates and cap rates, right? So like in the, you know, interest rates are still really, really high. And what that has done is it's kicked a lot of the financial buyers out of the buying process. You know, it always was a financial engineering situation for these financial buyers. It was how cheap can you borrow the money and put as little equity as you can into the acquisition? And then how much could you build it out either through acquisition? But in many cases, the big lever is new unit development. And then how much could you, you know, build new stores, and how much debt could you take on? And then how could you grow, you know, pay down your debt, raise your EBITDA, and then sell the business at a big, you know, kind of 5 to 7 years later at a big increase, and you feel good about it. Like, so that's kind of the formula for a lot of the financial buyers. And because interest rates are high, it's just the financial engineering equation doesn't work anymore. When I say anymore, I mean like right now. What does that mean? Like on our deals, I think I've said it in the past, very, very few financial buyers are looking at our deals now. It's amazing. Like we used to have, you know, like dozens and dozens and dozens, and now we have one or two or three. It's literally like almost like the Mojave Desert of financial buyers. They just don't exist at the moment in many cases. They'll come back, but I think what has to happen here is like right now, if you're going to buy a business, and this favors people who can actually operate businesses. I mean, you can buy a business, you operate it well, you know what you're doing, and you can have a great return on that investment. But the financial engineering piece of it, with interest rates as high as they are, just doesn't make sense. The other side of it being that the cost to build new units has doubled basically over the last 5 years too. So the returns on new unit development are lower. Until we get meaningful change in interest rates, until we get meaningful change in the cost of construction, I think, you know, that's going to be the second lever that's going to not get switched on for a while. So keep watching that. What happens in our economy this year? I don't know, but most people are saying we're going to have quite a few reductions in interest rates later on this year. We'll watch it and see. I've taken a couple of informal polls, just a buddy who owns a landscaping company, another buddy who's a roofer, another buddy who owns an IT company, okay, totally unrelated to what I do. But I asked each of them, I said, how you doing? You know, that's a general question, to which I'm like, they're like, oh yeah, you know, we're doing all right. The market is, you know, a little bit puzzling so far this year, but we're doing okay and making a profit, okay? Then I'd ask a more specific question, like, how do you expect your first quarter sales to be in 2024 versus 2023? And one of them said, down 40%, another said down 30, and the other said down 15. So you know what I mean? Ask specific questions, you get specific answers, but the temperature of those three random people in one area of the country in totally different occupations gives a pretty negative outlook about consumer spending. You know, so I just kind of make note of that until we get meaningful kind of changes in the interest rate environment, I think people are going to be pulling back, and we're going to see more of it this year. A third kind of thing is like brand specific, right? So what do we need for a turnaround? I mean, one is clearly we need a good looking trailing 12 P&L. Two, we need to have like better interest rate environment and lower cost of new development. And a third is we got to have, you know, good specific performance on a sales and traffic level in our industry and at the brand level. Some of that isn't like a blanket statement. Like, of course, QSR is going to go back to this model where we grow 1-2% in same store sales a year, right? With 1% newer units coming on board. And so therefore, we're all fighting for a couple of percentage points of growth in sales and profit. I mean, that's what it's always been in our industry. But a couple of things have happened. Like now we've got more competition, it seems like, coming in. I mean, you know, how many new coffee spots? We'll talk about this in a minute, but how many new coffee shops? In our little city of Gulf Breeze, Florida, we're fixing to have 6 coffee shops within a 500-yard area. Now get this, our city only has 5,000 people. That's crazy, right? So, you know what I mean? Like that's a factor of the competition. But overall, like, how's the industry doing? It should go back to kind of normal, right, soon. And then how is your brand doing? And brands are performing wildly differently across a spectrum. If you were to take a pen and paper and to write down 20 brands, right, the ones that you drive by every day, and, you know, take big ones, small ones, new ones, legacy ones, whatever, QSR, fast casual, even throw in a couple of non-restaurant franchise brands and list them on the page, Like, I could show you some crazy little graph of performance that I would just make up, and the performance would be way different within those brands at any one point in time. It's part of the reasoning why Yum Brands bought KFC, Taco Bell, and Pizza Hut, and then they tried it, and then they bought Long John Silver's and A&W. It's part of the reason why I'm sure the guys over at Restaurant Brands, you know, have, you know, Popeyes, you know, alongside Burger King, and they also bought Tim Hortons, right? And part of the reason behind Rourke's acquisition of all of these concepts that they have. It's also, you know, like Inspire Brands has a litany of concepts now too. You know, Constellation Brands too. Like, all these different brands are like creating diversification and putting their corporate know-how to each individual brand and sharing expenses and things at the top. But a lot of it is because some brands are up and some brands are down. It's nothing different than investing in a basket of stocks. They don't all move in the same direction at the same time. So, you know, that third piece of a turnaround is more brand specific. It's unlikely to happen if the first two conditions don't happen in terms of the amount of M&A activity and the amount of healthy M&A activity, but it is a factor overall. Okay, the next question, just two more questions. Lots of positive press is the next question in newer concepts, coffee, chicken, etc. And then the dreaded question, ready? What do you think? I always say that, but I ask my wife that when we're just talking about things. I'll say it like all the time, what do you think? And you remember that movie, The Founder? It was trying to portray Ray Kroc in the McDonald's story, and he was going around selling mixers. And he, as a mixer salesman to some of these kind of drive-through restaurants in the 1950s, he had portrayed him asking the question all the time of the franchisee after they tried his mixer, his shake mixer. He would say, "What do you think?" And then, of course, they'd all say, "This sucks. I'm not buying it. It's too expensive." You know, all that stuff. I always think about that when I ask that question. So, it was asked, "What do you think?" And I'm left with the conclusion that I said earlier, that with so many new coffee places coming in, it's kind of endemic of what the overall industry is experiencing. I mean, I think some of these new concepts are seeing the legacy brands drop unit counts, if we want to be particular about it, right? And they're seeing, like, you know, gosh, this brand used to have 5,500 units and now it has 3,800 units. And if you listen and you'll know which, and you're in that brand, you'll know which brand I'm talking about, because those are actual numbers. You might be in a brand that has, you know, 6,500 units, but really should have 5,000 units if we look at the return on investment of individual units across the country. You have brands that have 75 units that should have 6,000 units. These are legacy brands. When costs increase, it is no longer true that the good old days, you do $1 million in sales at a restaurant and make a lot of money. Those numbers now are like, you need to do $1.4 million in sales or you don't make any money, right? Because costs have come up so much all along the P&L, not just food costs and labor, but property taxes and insurance and rent and CAM charges and just some of these fixed expenses like uniforms and, you know, payments to vendors, all of it, you know? And so you can only hold the line on even sales so long. So you're seeing unit count reduce. And I think some of these new concepts are seeing that. I can see it out in the marketplace. These younger guys and girls who are starting these concepts are looking around and they're like, well, some of these legacy concepts, you know, kind of aren't addressing the Gen Z and millennial customer anymore. No one goes there. Go look at their locations and see. And I think we can beat their butt, you know, on Main and Main if we just locate across the street from them. And we can do it with newer assets. We can do it with higher AUVs. People aren't as price conscious on some of these new brands as they are with legacy brands, either because maybe the demographic of the customer is a little bit higher end, but also because it's perceived to be fresher, newer food. So these are all kind of reasons why, you know, I see a lot of new competition coming in. I mean, I saw McDonald's come, their CEO came out and said that they're going to be focusing on their low-end customer with value products, right? Which is probably a thing to do because everyone's raised their prices so much. They had to, I guess, in many cases to keep their profit levels, but they've raised their prices so much that they're unable now to cater to the lower-end customers. And we all knew that once cost came down, especially food costs came down, there's going to be a price war again and value is going to win because the value equation in the marketplace is really, frankly, unsustainable. I mean, traffic is dropping for that very reason. Hop in your car and go try 10 different places. I bet you're not even eating out as much as you used to, right? Because of the cost. So value is going to happen in discounting, and price sensitivity is going to start happening. McDonald's is focusing on the low-end customer. And all the while, I think these new concepts are kind of appealing to a different demographic that wants a different type of food, and they're marginalizing kind of the legacy QSR brands a little bit. I mean, I see it with my own kids, right? We have a Chipotle close to our house, and my kids, I mean, this is just some silly example, but my kids want to eat at Chipotle all the time, and they'll hardly go to another fast food place, you know? I mean, they'll go to a Chick-fil-A, they'll go to a Panda Express, oddly enough, and they'll go to a Chipotle. And, you know, of course, dad's in the industry, so I'm forcing him to go elsewhere. But that's about it. I mean, that's about it. You know what I mean? So, yikes. They love Cava, right? Our daughter loves Dutch Brothers. You can't get them in Florida, really, but you can in Texas area. They love Seven Brew. And they like the coffee shops, right? And they love the fresh food and fresh ingredients. So I think that pressure will continue to be placed against the legacy brands. And frankly, I think there's an easy, it's like a basketball. Let's use a basketball analogy, right? When I used to coach basketball, I would tell the kids to hustle. And don't assume because your teammate is on a breakaway that they're going to lay the ball in and it's going to go in. Hustle to the rim every single time. Hustle to the rim every single time, because guess what's going to happen? About 30% of the time, they're going to miss the layup or the dunk. And you're going to be the only guy under the basket to get a rebound and to put it right in for the easiest rebound and 2 points you're ever going to have. And you're going to be able to stuff your stats with what I call junk ball. You just play junk ball and you pick up the junk and put it back in and score. And it counts as the same 2 points, right? But I think a lot of this junk ball condition in our environment is going to be found by these new concepts, picking up an easy hustle to the basket kind of sales increases and taking some away from some of the legacy brands if they're not careful, just because they're not catering to the new demographic as much anymore. Cap rates, the last question, how are cap rates doing? Okay, so generally speaking, we're just in the marketplace talking about this. You have two major areas. You have the 1031 market, which are individual real estate buyers. Typically, these people are people who have sold something, maybe in California, and then they're looking to not pay taxes on it. So they do a 1031, and it forces them within a pretty short time frame to have to go buy another similar type of asset. And then they roll their money into it and they don't pay taxes on it. Okay, it's a pretty powerful phenomenon that's been in the industry for a long time. That's one type of real estate buyer. The other type of real estate buyer is a REIT, real estate investment trust. A lot of these are public, some are private. But these are, you know, big real estate holding companies that buy big swaths of real estate, not one property here or there, but like in our industry, like 25 properties, okay, or 30 or 50 or 100, maybe 10, whatever. So anecdotal comment on the REIT market right now is that we're just in the marketplace on, you know, probably $50 or $60 million of real estate. And I would say that I talking with well over a half dozen REITs, the cap rate environment is somewhere between 7.5 and 7.75, very predictably. That's where it is. And maybe you can do a little bit better with a master lease, but keep in mind, master leases are typically not approvable by a franchisor, and many franchisees just won't touch them. A master lease is where you pay a fixed amount of rent over all of the assets, not just on any one individually. So without a master lease, I think we're talking 7.5 to 7.75 cap rate in this market. Quite a big change. The REITs may have overcorrected, and they're certainly much more liquid to the fact that interest rates have increased. Now, on the 1031 market, it's not necessarily quite that way, because individuals have other reasons to invest in real estate, right? They are trying to avoid paying taxes right now. They want to defer taxes, or they have nowhere else to put the money, or their brother tells them they should do it, or they like real estate and daggone it, that's what they like. So there's all kinds of mispricing opportunities, but we can look at the 1031 market overall and we can gain some insights. So here's some insights I think they'll be valuable for you across all, you know, kind of, this is just kind of a looking at various pieces of data that I keep up with, and this is just a ballpark, okay? So go to your real estate advisor if you want better information. But as I kind of look at this from a high level, cap rates are probably about a full 100 basis points right now above where they were at their low point of, like, call it mid 2022. Average cap rates in the marketplace are probably that are getting done are probably around 6.5 to 6.75 cap, probably leaning more towards the 6.75 cap. You know, the activity in the marketplace is probably at or near a 5-year low, and has been hovering in the same kind of range for like the last year, more or less. You know, we don't know what will happen. Cap rates have largely flattened out relative to their last couple of months. So we don't know what's going to happen in terms of deals. But generally speaking, we're at kind of a 5-year low, and we've been hovering around that low at a constant pace for the last 6 to 9 months. And we'll see what happens this year. My guess is it's not going to change, or it may actually dip some more. Could be wrong. There is a gap right now of probably about a half. I mean, it's always this way. So know this, in the 1031 market, usually a buyer wants a half a turn of cap rate more than what they'll ultimately settle on. Does that make sense? So in other words, if the true closing market is at 6.75 cap, you can pretty well bet that a buyer is going to be asking 6.25 or 6.35. And ultimately the thing sits on the market longer than it has. And therefore it, you know, we end up having to negotiate, right? So there's more negotiating going on, and there's more price reductions that are happening over, let's say, 2021 and 2022. And then within the actual kind of details, I think we're going to see like that, you know, QSR continues to perform pretty well and has the most attractive kind of cap rates of a bundle. The worst is probably like office buildings, and then maybe, you know, kind of industrial buildings and those kinds of things. You know, obviously office buildings have taken a big whack with vacancies, right? And so their cap rates are going to probably be, generally speaking, I mean, this is a blanket comment, not particular to any geography, but they're going to be typically the worst. And QSR, especially ones that have, you know, tier one brands or ones with corporate guarantees or guarantees from large franchisees with over 100 locations, are typically going to fare in the best 20% of the cap rates in the environment. You might be able to see QSR cap rates, you know, being 25 to 50 basis points at times, depending on the deal, the brand, the location, the profitability, better than the average. And sometimes it could be worse by that amount, too. So that is a general cap rate update, and I think we'll just go ahead and close with that. Thank you all for listening. Feel free to reach out anytime. I think we'll be entering a period of the next 2 to 3 months of continued kind of quietness in the market. I think as we kind of try to, as an industry, lift our sales profits and traffic over last year, we're going to have some challenges in many brands over the next few months until we hit the summertime. And then I think it'll probably, you know, even out a little bit, and maybe conditions improve a little bit as we start seeing interest rates reduce. Until then, we'll be here. And thanks so much for listening to the Restaurant Boiler Room. Go Wildcats. See you later. Thanks so much for entering the Boiler Room today. You can find our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Spotify. If you like these podcasts, please listen, rate, and review. I also encourage you to visit our website at www.unbridledcapital.com for the best franchise M&A and financial resources in the industry. Our website includes webinars, podcasts, videos, white papers, and a list of our past M&A transactions. Please note that neither Rick Ormsby nor Unbridled Capital Advisors LLC give legal, financial, or tax advice. These podcasts represent opinions that have been prepared for informational purposes only. We expressly disclaim any and all liabilities that may be based on such information, errors therein, or omissions therefrom.